This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Wildfire season has begun in the Inland Northwest. The Spokane area hasn't yet seen any major fires, but crews from several Spokane County fire departments know it's only a matter of time. They're practicing how they'll react when they get the call. This week, they've been holding drills on a hilly, forested residential lot in the South Valley. While we were there observing, we heard at least one dispatcher on the radio beckon crews to a brush fire north of town. Wildfire memories run deep. People in central and eastern Washington still refer to the destructive fire seasons of 2014 and 2015. And Spokane Valley Fire Captain Paul Kimball remembers two fires in particular from last August.
As we saw last year with the Wellesley Fire and the Yale Fire, they both occurred on the same day. Their peak fire activity was only a few hours in length, and yet we had numerous structures lost. We had hundreds and hundreds of acres burned. So we may not see fires of as large of acreage as in the large complexes where there are hundreds of thousands of acres. We may not see that as much, but we can still have significant fire growth on specific days.
During this practice session, Kimball is instructing crews from his own department, from Spokane County Fire District 9, and the Washington Department of Natural Resources.
Spokane Valley firefighters, we were hired to be structure firefighters, go to car accidents, hazmat, medical calls. We weren't hired to be wildland firefighters. That wasn't why we took the job. But as part of our job as firefighters, we protect homes in the urban interface areas. So we still need to know how to dig handline, how to spray water, how to run chainsaws.
So Kimball and his training team, including Todd Belfi, put the group through a few drills to allow them to practice skills they haven't used since last summer.
So we're going to run it like a regular incident. 94 is going to be first on scene.
In this exercise, crews respond to a mock fire. They bring in large packs with hoses and connect them as they would during a wildfire call.
Anything that's in yellow ribbon is fire. Okay, so spray, but spray lightly so we don't burn through the water real quick.
The crews come in one at a time, as if arriving in a staggered wave. The first team hauls a hose from its tanker truck up the hill near the area where the fire would be burning. And then a second crew comes in with hand tools and attaches its hose to the first. And then a crew from another jurisdiction arrives. A two-person team with picks and shovels is assigned to put out a spot fire across the road. Small groups work their way up the hill as they would during a real fire. The commanders from the different jurisdictions communicate with each other and their teams in the field.
We have multiple starts. There's additional fires up the roadway here with the trail.
This is exactly the type of day when you might see a wildfire here. Temperatures in the 80s, low humidity, a bit of a breeze. Add a little lightning and a stronger wind, and you have the ingredients for a destructive fire. The brush is abundant, not surprising given the wet winter and spring. With warmer days, the vegetation is drying out. During another drill, the crews light a low-intensity fire on the hill so they can practice putting it out. Teams break out the chainsaws to practice in case fallen trees block their paths. Rick Fryer is a veteran Spokane Valley firefighter who says training sessions like this are always valuable.
There's some finer points that you always take from one of these classes. We practice those fine motor skills, those little things that we do. We also practice the way we communicate on the radios. And in this particular environment, the homeowners allowed us up here to do this. It's invaluable because you can't see, I can't see 40 feet because there's a hill with a little crest and some bushes. So radios are important.
Fryer says there's one other bit of preparation the Spokane Valley Fire Department has done to help them when they're dispatched to a fire within their jurisdiction.
We actually, a few years back, went and triaged the homes before the fire, and we listed them as green, which we can help. Yellow, we'll think about if we have resources. And red, this one we're going to consider lost. And so those can open people's eyes when we start saying, we're not going to protect your home. We can't guarantee the lives of the firefighters. We can't guarantee we're going to stop this fire from taking out your house. So we have to make a call. We're going to save the ones we can. And the way they help us is by taking time, educating themselves, and getting this information and putting a little bit of it to work, you know.
Fryer urges homeowners, especially those in the urban-suburban interface, to work with their local fire departments to check their homes and properties and minimize their chances of being overrun by fire. For years, Phil Huff, the executive director of the group Friends of the Scotchman Peaks, based in Sandpoint, Idaho, has worked to convince the federal government to designate the remote area as wilderness. The peaks are a set of craggy mountains in an area that straddles the Idaho-Montana border north and east of Lake Pend'Oreille.
It's one of the last and largest wild roadless areas in our region. And folks for many decades have actually been engaged with the process of trying to make it a designated wilderness, going back into the 1970s when the Forest Service conducted reviews of their lands to determine which areas were roadless and which areas were suitable for wilderness. They identified the Scotchman Peaks roadless area as one of the prime candidates in our region.
And now, nearly 40 years later, it appears there is finally consensus for the proposal. A little more context, the Forest Service first recommended the area be declared wilderness 30 years ago. Shanda Dacomi, the forest's ecosystem staff officer, says it means traditional uses such as hiking and berry picking are allowed, but no mining, no timber harvest, no motorized vehicles. That wouldn't change if the area is formally designated as wilderness.
What's going to change, though, are going to be smaller things like the Forest Service or any of their agents, like anybody that's volunteering for us, can use things like handheld motorized equipment like chainsaws in recommended wilderness. If it becomes designated wilderness, that will not be the case. Nobody will be allowed to use chainsaws at all.
Ann Dacomi says the size of groups traveling through the area would be limited.
A party wouldn't be able to have more. The maximum would be 12, what they call 12 heartbeats. So that would be like 10 people and 2 mules. And then, you know, they have to be a certain distance apart.
Last December, the political process began toward declaring Scotchman Peaks as wilderness. Idaho U.S. Senator Jim Risch introduced a bill. It had the support of the Bonner County Commissioners and the local Chamber of Commerce and other groups. But it was so close to the end of the session that the legislation went nowhere. And now Risch is apparently ready to try again. On Tuesday, his staff held an open house in the town of Hope, Idaho, to review his proposal one more time. And after 12 years of working the issue, Phil Huff is optimistic about the bill's chances. What is it for you that makes that place so special?
My wife and I have hiked the Triple Crown of long-distance trails in the United States, the Appalachian Trail, the Continental Divide Trail, and the Pacific Crest Trail, passing through many wilderness areas. When we moved to Idaho 17 years ago, we found in the Scotchman Peaks a place that was as wild or wilder than almost any place we've visited in the lower 48.
Why has it taken so long to get so many people to this point?
In 1964, when Congress passed the Wilderness Act, they immediately put into play a certain number of wilderness areas across the western U.S. mostly, but they provided a process for adding new wilderness areas. What this made was a fundamentally slow and deliberative process. In order to get a law passed, you have to get a lot of people agreeing. And when it's a lands law, the delegation, the congressional delegation from whose state the lands are in, has to support it. And most politicians will look to their local constituents to determine how much support there is. So essentially, that process ensures that there is a grassroots effort to designate an area as wilderness. And putting together a grassroots effort and bringing all of the interests to the table and breaking down the mythologies around wilderness, the fears around each other's values about how we use the land, that takes time. And so over 12 years, we've managed to reach out and speak to many stakeholders from many diverse backgrounds. And what we have found across that is that there's a large consensus of folks who want to protect and preserve some of the natural landscape in which we live. But they might express it differently than traditionally some conservation groups. So taking the time to find the language, find the common threads, put together that consensus, it's been a very interesting and worthwhile experience. But one of the things that comes out of it is just how long it takes to have those conversations and build those relationships.
And so what is it about this particular proposal that has gotten people to sign on? I assume this is sort of a compromise version after all those 12 years.
When we sat down and looked at the forest plan, in 2005, one of the things that leapt out to a number of us is how obvious that the best use of the Scotchman Peaks area would be as wilderness. As a group, we believe that there's plenty of room on the other 2.5 million acres in the Idaho Panhandle Forest for all of the other multiple uses, including timber production, mining, grazing, responsible off-highway vehicle use. But we look at the multiple use of wilderness and where it's most appropriate and best used, and the Scotchman Peaks leaped out as one of the most obvious examples that the best use of the Scotchman Peaks would be as wilderness.
So now that Senator Risch introduced it last year and presumably will introduce it again this year, do you feel confident that it's going to get through Congress soon, or are you looking at another 12 years before Congress acts on it?
But we are hopeful that the critical mass of support that has developed and is developing in our communities will carry the bill forward to see an introduction this year, and that will carry it through Congress. What we know is that Senator Risch is listening to his constituents, and before he does anything more, he needs to hear from a lot of supporters. But once he does, he has the ability, as a very conservative senator in a chamber that's run by the conservatives, to be able to work through that process. And so we find someone who's very effective at his job, and we're hopeful that his interest in the Scotchman Peaks, built upon the community's interest, will carry it through Congress.
Phil Huff is the executive director of the Friends of the Scotchman Peaks. He spoke to us from Sandpoint. This is the Inland Journal. And now a warning. This next story has some graphic elements that you might not want children to hear. We had an interesting guest stop by the station last week. His name is Matt Pomerenke.
P-O-M-E-R-I-N-K-E.
So where do you live?
I live in Longview, Washington, other side of the state.
And what do you do there?
I am a papermaker by trade. I work for Capstone Paper.
He calls himself a millbilly, and this was one of his days off. He'd come to the other side of the mountains to talk with students. He was accompanied by two men from the Washington Department of Labor and Industries, and that gives you a hint about his reason for being here. Here's another hint. Part of his left forearm is made of metal. So show me your arm.
So
it's a double hook, or one hook that splits into two, right?
Yes, it is. I actually have two different styles of these. This one's more metal, and it's actually a little more computerized. It's really good for my work when I'm doing my stock job, because I'm around a lot of water and chemicals, and this one's chemical resistant, water resistant. I also have another one that's more plastic. It's a little lighter weight. It's one I usually wear more often, just because how heavy it is.
18 years ago, Matt Pomerenke lost part of his arm in an industrial accident. And now, in addition to his vocation as a papermaker, he's an advocate for workplace safety, especially with high school students. And there's certainly a need for the message. According to Labor and Industries, 675 people younger than 18 were hurt at the workplace in Washington last year. That number has steadily risen during the last 5 years. Most of the injuries are minor, cuts and sprains and burns. About two-thirds of those injured were 17, almost one-third were 16. Pomerenke was 21 when he was hurt. He was finishing up a shift at the lumber mill.
I was cleaning up after work, doing the same thing I'd probably done 1,000 other times, and I was actually cleaning up around a different conveyor system that dumped into mine, and I noticed a stick sticking out of the drive motor. There was no guard on it, and it was just part of the landscape. I'd seen it before, and I didn't think much of it. And this time I reached up and I pulled on the stick, and when I did, it caught the back edge of the belt and it rotated down just enough, and it got in the bite where the chain and sprocket wraps together like on a bicycle, and the stick snapped. And when it did, it gave me a little jerk forward, and it was just enough that it caught my shirt sleeve on the chain, and it started wrapping me up into the motor drive. And ultimately, it destroyed the whole section of my left arm from about my wrist up to my upper part of my forearm.
And how did that feel? I mean, was it
honestly?
People talk about shock,
yeah,
and they don't feel anything.
I didn't. When it happened, it felt like somebody picked up a 2x4 off the chain and swung and hit me as hard as they could in the arm. Just tons of pressure for a second, and then I couldn't feel anything. I mean, like you said, I instantly went into shock. I couldn't feel anything on the whole left side of my body. And I had to stand there for 45 minutes. They had to take the thing apart around me to actually get me out of there that night.
So somebody saw the accident. So,
yeah, one of my
lucky,
best friends.
Lucky you, huh? That
yeah.
You weren't all alone there.
Yeah, it was one of my best friends to this day. He's the one that got to hear me scream when it happened and turn just in time to watch me get drug into that conveyor.
So what happened after that?
He ran down the side of the conveyor and he shut it off and he started the emergency process for us. And I was stuck there. I was stuck for 45 minutes. They literally, like I said, take the thing apart around me. And from my point of view, I could either lay my face against the motor that was in front of me that was hot, so I was leaning back, And I had two choices of things to look at. I could either look at my arm, or I could look at one of my best friends since kindergarten sitting at the end of the chain with his head in his hands crying because he didn't know what to do, and he didn't ultimately know how to help me. Luckily, a few others at the mill did. One in particular, Marty, he ran straight down the chain to me and got a tourniquet on my arm, and he stopped the bleeding. And it also made him so sick to his stomach, he basically threw up for 20 minutes straight until the paramedics got there. He saved my life that night.
As you can imagine, that accident had a profound effect on Matt Pomerenke's life. He went back to work at a paper mill and got involved in workplace safety issues.
Through a committee I'm on in the pulp and paper industry, they asked me to go up and talk for 10 minutes about my accident. And I did it, and I cried like a baby the whole time. And there was one lady in the audience, Lena Wang, that saw me, and she said, I have a perfect thing for you to do. Would you like to go into high schools and talk to kids about safety? And I said, are you nuts? High school kids are mean. No. And she kind of talked to me a little bit and told me about the Injured Young Workers Program through the state of Washington and kind of talked to me a little bit about it. And I was, I'll go check it out. And I actually went and watched one of their other speakers do it. And it was pretty impactful to me. And I started thinking about it. You know, my daughter, she was only 10 at the time, but, you know, she turned 16 in 2 weeks. I'm going to have a kid of a working age. And I've been doing this for 6 years now, which still amazes me because I don't see myself as a public speaker at all. I work in a mill. But if one kid I've talked to in the last 6 years ends up training my daughter and shows her the right way to do things, not only do I feel like it really helped their career out, but I mean, that's somebody that's helping my family directly. So that right there makes it all worth it for me.
So you said high school kids were mean.
Yeah.
Are they mean when you go talk to them, you know, and ask questions?
No, high school kids, I joke around about that, but high school kids are the best. I mean, they have no inhibitions, really. I mean, they're so attentive. And we'll go into different classrooms, and the teacher will apologize before we even start. Hey, I'm sorry, I have a very rambunctious class. And then we watch a little movie first, and then I talk. And a lot of times you go in there, and it doesn't matter how rambunctious the teacher thinks it is. You could hear a pin drop. I mean, they hang on every word I say. And then at the end, we always leave a little time for questions. And one of the things with kids is they're fearless. You know, I've done this presentation in mills and different lumber mills and paper mills. And, you know, you get done, and adults, they just want to go to work. I mean, they want to process what you said. Well, kids are so actively thinking the whole time that they've already been processing it, and they just, oh, well, how does this work? How do you do this? Well, why do you do that? I mean, they're fearless. They'll ask you anything. We've had presentations where I'll go up there and talk for 45 minutes, then we answer questions for a half hour. Kids are great. They really are.
And what sorts of questions do they ask you?
Lots of questions about how it works, how my arm works. I wear a myoelectric prosthetic. I get lots of questions about that. I get lots of questions about phantom pains, my mental state. Kids, they are very curious, and I talk a little bit about it anyways. How it affected me, what my kids think of it, what people just in general think of it. Is there anything I can't do after my accident? Parts of my life that, you know, I've had to give up, which is very few and far between. If I still do most of the stuff I did before, really, I mean, it's pretty open-ended. One kid wanted to teach me how to play guitar because he figured out how to do it single with one hand. I was a little much for me. I'm good. I don't think I need another hobby.
Matt Pomerenke is a workplace safety speaker for the Washington Department of Labor and Industries and a paper mill worker in Longview. We have 5 more minutes of interview that we didn't have time to play here. He talks more about his prosthetic equipment and the subjects about which he talks to students. You can listen online at the Inland Journal page at the Spokane Public Radio website. Last weekend at Feltz Field, the Historic Flight Foundation, based in Everett, brought some of its vintage airplanes to this side of the Cascades. Our own resident aviation buff, Steve Jackson, went to take a look and a ride.
It was quite a sight to behold as several vintage piston-driven aircraft were lined up on the tarmac at Feltz Field. They included a P-51 Mustang, T-6A, F8F Bearcat fighter, TBM Avenger DHC-2 Beaver, and the classic airliner of the late 1930s and 40s, the Douglas DC-3. Members of the media were given an opportunity to take a short flight on the DC-3. That plane revolutionized the airline industry, and over 16,000 copies of the plane were made. A huge number of those served as military transport planes during World War II with the designation of C-47. Pilot Eugene Vizzetti says this particular plane, now in classic American Airlines paint scheme, was originally a military transport.
This was one of 300 that were built specifically to fly the hump. When the Japanese took over the main highway going to Nanjing in China, mm-hmm. what we had to do is get supplies into the inland, pretty much from India and hence over the Himalayas into central China.
After the war, the plane did service as a Chinese airliner before being purchased by a couple of American companies, including Johnson & Johnson, who used it as a corporate airliner. The cabin remains the same as that era, featuring two large bunks and rather luxurious captain's chairs. On my own short flight in the vintage airliner, I was struck by how relatively modern the plane seems, given that the first DC-3s began flying in 1936. The flight was at low altitude over Spokane, and the winds that day made the flight feel like you were on a rather large boat, bobbing around in the sky. The Historic Flight Foundation is run by John Sessions, who is qualified to fly most of the planes in the collection, ranging from a post-World War I biplane to a Korean War-era F-86 Sabre jet. For John, the collection represents the golden era of the age of flight, where new planes were being developed every week, and where the pioneers of that era can serve as an inspiration to us now in this much different age.
We had courageous people, we had innovative entrepreneurs, we had people who were taking risks every weekend flying these things, and if they succeeded, they could become wealthy, they could have a government contract, they could, you know, have many companions, they were like rock stars. But if they didn't succeed, they often pay with their lives.
If you missed last weekend's show at Feltz Field, you can always visit the Historic Flight Foundation at Payne Field in Everett, Washington. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
You can hear Inland Journal, our weekly public affairs program, every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on KSFC, or you can listen to full programs or individual stories online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Glad you joined us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.